Welcome to this first session of Marxism 2018. My name's Beck and I'm going to be facilitating the session today. Just a few announcements before we get the session underway. The building is open the whole weekend and we have coffee, morning tea, lunch and everything available here on the campus. And there will be lunch and dinner trucks on Dodd Street just outside, so no need to leave the campus for the weekend. One other thing that's important is that no one's allowed to film or record any of the conference proceedings unless you have a media lanyard. So if you're wanting to do that and you haven't got one, please get that at the registration desk. And we're also encouraging guests to spend time at the Secret Garden, which is off Grant Street, and it's the area where people can gather in the breaks to have their coffee, have their discussions, eat lunch, and so on. So that's definitely a place that people should look out for. But without further ado, I'm going to introduce our speaker on the session, Kill All Normies, What's Behind the Rise of the Alt-Right. And I'm really pleased to introduce to you Simon Burns, who's a member of Socialist Alternative in Melbourne, but he's also an activist with the Campaign Against Racism and Fascism and also a militant unionist involved in the Electrical Trades Union. So please make him very welcome.
Hail Trump, hail our people, hail victory. With this updated English translation of Sieg Heil from Richard Spencer shortly after Donald Trump's election in the 2016 US presidential elections, fascism and white supremacy burst to prominence in politics in the United States. The next year, in 2017, it wasn't a new thing that the majority of terror-related killings in the US was committed by right-wing extremists, but the number that they killed doubled from the previous year. So I think a fascist tradition with quite deep roots and a long pedigree in the US that had been broadening out quite massively into the legions of internet trolls and memers since the global financial crisis was beginning to find its feet. And also in the streets, I think, and also to find its tiki torches. The so-called alt-right was rising. And I think it's important for us to understand this movement and others like it around the world in order to beat it. And I want to show today that Marxism is the best framework to do this, not just because it seeks to do away with capitalism and rid the world of the system that perennially gives rise to fascism and movements like this, but also because it provides the tools to understand where they come from and how they operate, which best equips us to fight them in the here and now. Now, I want to underline the importance of taking movements like this very seriously, even when they're small, because when you understand them in the context of a system that shelters them and periodically gives space for them to grow massively, and the underlying logic of violence and intimidation against their political enemies that I think is at their core, you can see the threat is very serious, even though sometimes latent, it's ever-present as well. So I think the first thing to say in a description of the alt-right is that they're head-spinningly hard to describe. They intentionally obscure their ideas and their politics through kind of, you know, labyrinths and layers of irony and memes, which we'll see more of later, which makes it difficult to draw out their actual positions a lot of the time. They aren't one coherent organisation, obviously. There's sort of a bunch of organisations and a bunch of individuals kind of spread around and interacting with each other. And a number of sort of actually competing tendencies, I think, politically, that openly disagree with each other. So what I'll do today is try to give a bit of a sense of the range of their politics by drawing on kind of some of the stuff that their leaders have written and also some of the stuff that they sort of do online and in the real world. So firstly, and I think actually most importantly, is how do we sort of broadly categorise this movement? And I think that we should categorise them as a fascist movement. I think that's the fundamental dynamic that's at play. And I think that's true with a few qualifications. One is that they're obviously not ideologically coherent, as I've said. And I think... Yeah, also, the space for their politics at the moment is widening out, but it's nowhere near at the heights that it's sort of risen to historically, where fascism has, you know, risen to power in, like, revolutions and counter-revolutions. I think this is an important debate, not just as a kind of, you know, point of kind of interest, but to sort of appreciate the gravity of them, to put them in a historical lineage of the fascist movement, to sort of appreciate the kind of heights that it can rise to. And also just sort of understanding the historic logic that underlies them to more effectively beat them, sort of where they really draw their nourishment from and where they come from. So the qualifications to this argument, as I said, yeah, I think the fascists, self-identified fascists within the alt-right are a minority, and actually a lot of people around the movement would reject the label. But I think the main thing in identifying fascist movements is actually not swastikas and brown shirts and people who call themselves fascists. I think it's a historical dynamic that's inherent in the system of capitalism as a system of class struggle, revolution, and counter-revolution. are not a self-identification or a set of symbols, as a lot of sort of smaller liberal historians would have you believe. I think it's a logic in right-wing movements whose centrality in that movement depends on the state of class struggle and kind of political ferment in society and the political space available to it, which varies along history. And I think the alt-right is a fascist movement in a historic period where the space for open fascism, though growing, I think, as the mainstream moves to the right, is still limited. You know, there's no mass workers' movement at the moment. There's no counter-revolution. There's no kind of large layer of returned soldiers as there was in Germany in the 30s. But my main argument is that they are still a movement that's well and truly kind of swimming in that stream of history for two main reasons. Because they seek to be a mass right-wing movement, and this, one of their central kind of political weapons is violence and intimidation against their opponents. And I'll go into that a bit later. But a quote first to kind of sum up that argument from one historian of fascism. In the course of its life, fascism shuffles together every myth and lie that the rotten history of capitalism has ever produced, like a pack of greasy cards, and then deals them out to whoever it thinks they will win. What is important is not the ideas themselves, but the context in which they operate. Many of the ideas of fascism are the commonplaces of all reactionaries, but they are used in a different way. Fascism differs from the traditional right-wing parties, like the Conservative Party, not so much in its ideas, but in that it is an extra-parliamentary mass movement which seeks the road to power through armed attacks on its opponents. So by fascist, I mean two central things. First, it seeks to become a mass movement in a way that is essential to it because, secondly, its politics points towards making gains and driving society to the right through violent activity outside the existing state against its political enemies. Its main organisations and leaders put great emphasis on this recruitment and movement building rather than sort of recruiting to existing political institutions or parties, and I think that's important. They emphasise that cultural change comes before political change. And I think mass mobilisations in the streets that we've seen over the last couple of years and individual acts of violence are an important part of this for their movement. And the Charlottesville rally that people probably saw last year is a good example of this, where the alt-right actually managed to kill a left-wing activist. So I think also there's a tendency towards the use of violence that's quite essential to their politics that aims to drive society to the right. Not just random acts of violence, but against very particular groups of people, against their political enemies, specifically, I think, the left and oppressed groups. The Southern Poverty Law Centre calculated that there was a total of 43 people killed by the alt-right and members of it since 2014 and 67 people injured, and that the number that they killed in 2017 was double that they killed in 2016. So there's sort of a spike that's happening. And I think any number of... This might be a strange way at it, but bear with me. Any number of popular memes on the alt-right, I think, demonstrate this violence, actually, and are key to the way that people are actually sort of brought into the movement on a mass level and radicalised. So, for instance, normalising ideas like killing left-wing activists or genocide and things like the Holocaust. So I think this is a pretty good demonstration of that. Mm. Obviously, Auschwitz, one of the death camps during the Holocaust, just sort of being brought into this, you know, joking kind of, you know, frame with Donald Trump. And, yeah, I'll come back to this a bit later on in more detail. And I think also just quite straight up, one organisation called the Proud Boys has actually fighting a left-wing activist as one of its degrees of initiation alongside reciting the names of serials sort of while you're getting punched in the head and getting a tattoo of the organisation somewhere on your body. I think further, the ideas, rather than being the central kind of diagnosing factor in whether or not something's fascist, sort of reflect these core elements of their politics, particularly the violence. And also I think the centrality of sort of white victimhood and the need to defend against the groups that are held responsible for that. So I think the more obvious manifestations of that are people like Steve Bannon, who says that armed conflict is the only way to save European society from Islam, or just other explicit calls for genocide, like Richard Spencer, sort of the guy who coined the term the alt-right, his call for the ethno-state and sort of, you know, just basically mass non-white immigration away from the United States. I think more generally, kind of the assembly of various different oppressive ideas into a radicalised overall worldview that points to that sort of political violence as a way of fixing the situation. And I think one example of that is one sort of prominent blogger who started off in the alt-right as what they call a pickup artist. He sort of put it this way. Women's economic freedom is leading to civilizational collapse. White civilization is being destroyed by miscegenation, immigration and low white female birth rates owing to feminism. This decline can only be undone by deporting minorities and restoring patriarchy. So how do they kind of present the arguments generally? I think some of their main themes overall, as I've said, are white supremacy and cultural identity, and traditional gender roles and anti-leftism. And I think melded together, they construct sort of a worldview that's got victimhood at its heart and the need to take on political enemies, as I've said. So white victimhood and identity in some form, I think, is sort of central to the whole alt-right. In the words of Andrew Anglin, who's a founder of a prominent sort of neo-Nazi website called The Daily Stormer, which you could sort of say is one of the far-right edges of the alt-right, the alt-right celebrates the greatness of our ancestors and the glory of our historical achievements, rejecting revisionist arguments by modern social scientists, which portray whites as having wrought evil on the planet. We view whites as the creators and maintainers of Western civilization. I think a little picture of Cheddar Man gives a good kind of counterpoint to that. Richard Spencer, this was, by the way, a person who was found, I guess, from, you know, the early stages of even the establishment of Britain, and sort of showing that, you know, the earliest kind of people who inhabited that island were not, in fact, white, but had, you know, the skin tone of Cheddar Man with his sort of knowing grin there. Now, Richard Spencer, who's a prominent alt-right speaker and publisher, as well as the guy who came up with the term alt-right, says he understands race as something between a breed and an actual species. But like much of the alt-right, he's also prone to pitching it in terms of identity. So there's that sort of biological and then the kind of more cultural side of it. And Milo Yiannopoulos, who people have probably heard of, the self-styled leader of the troll army of the alt-right, who actually, when he came to Melbourne last year, people hopefully are also aware of, faced one of the sort of best anti-racist protests that this city's seen in years and years, emphasises that cultural side as well, sort of saying, you know, it's tribe and it's culture. So he leans less on the kind of biological and skin colour basis of identity, but sort of just implies it through eugenicist arguments about race and gender. I think it's a good smokescreen for them, and sort of one that's used by what people call the alt-light, which is a distinction I'll come back to later. Now, the alt-right, I think, critically extend this kind of idea of race into nationalism, arguing for a kind of blood and soil white nation and against kind of, you know, multiculturalism and whatnot. So Spencer, in a prominent interview with a black BBC journalist, confidently and stridently just said to the journalist that he'd never be British because he's black. And I think that sort of, yeah, sums it up pretty well. The answer to this, for him, is the ethnic cleansing of the so-called white countries, self-deportation, in Spencer's words, and he favours a US white ethno-state and a pan-national white empire modelled on some approximation of the Roman Empire. Andrew Anglin from The Daily Stormer doesn't attempt to argue for this sort of non-violence. He just says, there's a rapidly approaching time in every white Western city where corpses will be stacked in the streets as high as men can stack them, and you're either going to be stacking or getting stacked. So I think, as I've said, an important aspect of what all this builds to is white victimhood, because it's one of the key mobilising ideas of the whole movement. So for Anglin, the core concept of the movement upon which all else is based is that whites are undergoing an extermination via mass immigration into white countries, which was enabled by a corrosive liberal ideology of white self-hatred, and that the Jews are at the centre of this agenda. And I think that's sort of the basis of the Jews will not replace us chant that everyone probably remembers from the Charlottesville rally. And I think another underpinning sort of this whole genetic white superiority thing is obviously non-white inferiority, and they put a lot of emphasis on this. And they sort of lean on, you know, research about things like IQ scores and crime statistics, and they sort of call it race realism. And I think people might want to talk about how that really intersects with a lot of mainstream discussions around race, particularly on people on campuses. I think like things like the bell curve and whatnot that came out, you know, making basically those same arguments, they really kind of shade into the mainstream and all of that stuff. I think it's also important to say that anti-Muslim racism is a pretty, you know, being the favoured racism of the ruling class globally, I think, is also a key feature of their racism. So Milo kind of relates it to the liberal Islamophobia argument that, you know, there's this essential Muslim culture that doesn't integrate with Western values, like he says, capitalism, freedom of speech and respect for women and gay people. And people probably heard the Neil Mitchell interview when Milo came to Australia, where basically they sort of both ended up, well, Milo said, oh, well, don't let in Syrian refugees because your daughters will get raped and all your public services will get taken. And Neil Mitchell was sort of outraged until he found out that Milo was only talking about the Muslims. And Neil Mitchell wanted to say, oh, well, there's Christians as well. But we can both agree that that's something true to say of Muslims, which I think is foul. And again, an indication of that sort of shading into the mainstream. And Steve Bannon, who I mentioned earlier, the former Breitbart editor and former chief strategist of Donald Trump's administration, emphasises Islam as one of the main threats to Western society, and as this conquering force that sort of aims to establish the Islamic States of America, he calls it. And Bannon, it should be noted, was the chief architect of Trump's Muslim ban. So I think onto, gender. At a mass level, I think the alt-right is really driven by a deep hatred and resentment towards women, and an obsession with women as simultaneously manipulative social climbers and sex objects. So politically, the movement, I think, it says it's opposed to the gains that have been made in women's rights. And their politics around that ranges from sort of open celebration of violence and forced pregnancy and sort of domestic violence. And then a form of biological determinism as well that I think you see in figures like Miley Yiannopoulos. In Richard Spencer's words, as with the claim that all races are equal, the claim that men and women are equal is looked at as entirely ridiculous by the alt-right. We believe in abolishing feminism and re-establishing traditional gender roles in society, a process which would involve sending women back to the home to produce and raise children, largely removing them from the workplace. Another prominent Daily Stormer writer just argued that rape is a property crime and domestic violence against women is, you know, both necessary and desirable in a household. So I think the case of Elliot Rodger is kind of instructive in some of this stuff. Now, Elliot Rodger, if people haven't heard of him, was a guy who tried to shoot up a sorority house, sort of a halls of residence at a US college, because he'd been to college for a number of years and was still a virgin and wanted to punish women for not seeing that he was, in his words, the ultimate gentleman, and that they were sleeping with men who he thought were racially inferior to him. So kind of you see that combination of blaming kind of, you know, both women and non-white people for all of his grievances in life and sort of bringing that together. So he went and shot six people and killed them and then killed himself and was sort of active in, you know, not the openly Nazi sections of the movement, which I think is important, but sort of just the general kind of, you know, chat room, like, you know, boards and stuff around 4chan, which is a place where people discuss how, you know, quote, women prefer alpha males and either cynically use or completely ignore beta males, by which they mean low-ranking males in this sort of stark and vicious social hierarchy through which they interpret all human interaction. And I think one thing that I'll show now but return to is the sort of appropriation of Elliot Rodger as this kind of hero through memes by the alt-right. And it shows us kind of how I think, you know, that sort of thing gets valorized and built into the culture and sort of normalized. Now, this is Elliot Rodger down the bottom here. And obviously that's like kind of a representation of him going into a room full of, like, you know, college, what they would call normies, with the women being in the front, and he's going to kill them. And, you know, that's something that the alt-right just sort of spreads around, you know, laughs about, normalises, kind of, you know, I think a real valorisation of that sort of politics. So as I said, Miley Yiannopoulos uses this biological determinist kind of argument to attack the idea that women are actually oppressed at all, and to mobilise this sense of victimhood among men at the hands of women. So the women are the sort of agents of this. In a televised interview, he's argued that women are naturally drawn to the caring professions. Therefore, the pay gap is attributable to essential biological characteristics. If anything, it's men and boys who are oppressed. Under 30s in the US and the UK, men get paid less than women. Boys are put on Ritalin because they don't meet feminised standards of behaviour. Women actually get advantages. So you see, yeah, men are the real victims and women are sort of the agents. And I think, again, you know, seeing him take on a lot of smaller liberal commentators and just generally shred them with this unsubstantiated kind of nonsense is really telling. So on anti-Semitism, which I think is actually a key part of the worldview of a large section of the alt-right, to sort of more and less theorised degrees, I think it's worth saying that I think there's a part of this that forms their kind of theory about having an anti-elite form of racism, as well as, like, kick-up racism as well as kick-down, even though it's bullshit. They construct it in this way where, you know, they equate the sort of elite and the ruling class with Jews, to kind of give them with this ultimate political enemy, the shadowy hand that's sort of controlling all of the groups that are against them, and the sort of ultimate enemy that needs to be removed to fix everything. I'll come back to that a bit later on as well. Richard Spencer puts it like this: Jews are an ethno-religious people distinct from Europeans. At various times, they've existed within European societies without being of them. The preservation of their identity as Jews was and is contingent on resistance to assimilation, sometimes expressed as hostility towards their hosts. Judeo-Christian values might be a quaint political slogan, but it is a distortion of the historical and metaphysical reality of both Jews and Europeans. Now, Kevin B. MacDonald is one of the key figures that they cite in making these arguments. He's a retired psychology professor from California State University who applied evolutionary psychology to Jews and sort of argued that they had evolved a higher than average verbal intelligence and an ethnocentrism of their own. and that they use these advantages to undermine non-Jewish white majorities in Western countries, including by advocating mass immigration. So there's that sort of white genocide with the Jews kind of enacting it idea. So now I want to turn to where they've come from. Because I think with a few mediations, basically the alt-right, like all fascist movements, comes directly out of the machinations of capitalism, with its oppression, its alienation, and its tendency towards crisis. I think it's worth briefly going through the recent history that's prepared the ground for them to give a sort of sense of that, chiefly, I think, the era of neoliberalism and sort of austerity, and then the global financial crisis. And I think, importantly, within that, the retreat of the socialist left and the workers' movement. And I think this broader context mainly shows how they aren't just this aberration, but a product of a continuing historical situation that just isn't going anywhere anytime soon. So for a period after World War II, fascism was considered really beyond the pale in the countries that had fought the Nazis in World War II, in a way. Fascist movements like the KKK in the US, at least publicly, were not sort of considered acceptable, you know, in polite society, at least in the open. In the late 70s, with, I think, the onset of neoliberalism, this began to change. And fascist organisations began to form in a more coherent way in Europe and to make electoral gains, as we're sort of seeing the sort of ongoing effects of now. The same was not true in the US, where there was sort of a sizable but quite fragmented fascist population who sort of focused on permeating the Republican Party. And an example of their success in this was in 1991, where David Duke, an open Nazi sympathiser and Ku Klux Klan leader, was nominated by the Republican Party to run for the governor of Louisiana, and he almost won. So two main factors, I think, really account for the end of the isolation of fascism historically. The first, I think, is the retreat of the workers' movement and the socialist left, which, you know, could put forward an argument and fight for a politics of solidarity, and that all oppressed people, rather than being the agents of, you know, of oppression, are oppressed and also have an interest in fighting together with the ultimate goal of overthrowing capitalism and gaining liberation for all oppressed people of all colours. And I think this retreat has meant a shift in mainstream politics to the right overall, and a weakened and liberalised left that's unable actually to take on a lot of the arguments of fascism anywhere near as effectively. I think an extreme example of this is a journal called Telos, which people might have seen. This was a journal that formed in the 1970s around the New Left, and sort of increasingly through the years just turned right further and further as it retreated, I think, from the idea of the working class as a revolutionary subject. And sort of started to accept the arguments of, you know, people like Herbert Marcuse around that they're bored off, you know, it's all done. And I think where that led them was this search for what they called, you know, politics that could act as a what's called authentic expressions outside of capitalism and state power, and to react against social alienation. So they started to talk more about things like populism, and, you know, that meant ethno-nationalism and anti-immigration. So they were sort of writing more about that, and sort of, you know, white identity became another theme. And I think the other main factor in the rise of today's fascism, and this is key, has just been the rise of racism and nationalism during the era of neoliberalism as just a response of the mainstream to the crisis. And I think this forms a really rich soil out of which the fascists grow and out of which the alt-right has definitely grown. And I think, you know, racism and nationalism is always a key part of how the ruling class sort of structures the world and retains power under capitalism, but I think it's really intensified under neoliberalism. So I think since the fall of the Berlin Wall, the war on terror, you know, so-called, has seen an unrelenting campaign of racism against Muslims, and just the normalisation really across the board that, you know, Muslims are to blame for the increasing insecurity in Western societies. And I think this ramped up even further with the global financial crisis in 2007. You know, so in the US, just generally speaking, the Obama administration oversaw an even higher number of deportations of illegal immigrants, so-called, than the Bush administration did. As well as a record high rate of police killings of unarmed black people. So just a real ramping up of that kind of racism. I think the other thing to say is alienation and a sense of just bitter social fragmentation is this really normal feature of life under capitalism. But I think through the neoliberal era, that's also intensified. You know, with kind of the institutions of collective engagement, I think, with society, like trade unions, have just been eroded. And I think the ruling class's vision of there is no alternative and there is no society, but only atomised individuals, has just faced less resistance. And I think this vision's come to dominate more and more, both ideologically in society and also in terms of how people, you know, well, how people conceive themselves in society, but materially as well, with the erosion of things like the welfare state and the breaking up of working class communities. And as always, I think the more atomized middle class sort of felt the effects of this quite keenly, which I'll get back to and is important. I think that bitter alienation sort of worsening, combined with this absolute kind of hate-drenched misanthropy that you see through the alt-right as soon as you look at them, is one of the sort of latent bases of the movement that exists just in normal capitalism. And I think that furnishes you with, you know, a layer of people who are sort of ripe, all this together, you know, a layer of people who are kind of ripe for, with a bit of political discussion, a little bit of movement, can sort of be convinced into kind of, you know, engaging with the movement and getting active. So I think all of that intensified, as I said, with the global financial crisis, when, you know, people might know the sort of labyrinthine operations of the global financial market just caused this massively deep crisis in most of the developed capitalist countries. And the Obama administration bailed out the sinking banks to the tune of trillions of dollars. Now people talk about third world conditions in the US, crumbling infrastructure, chronic financial insecurity and decaying public institutions, with, I think, this creeping sense of desperation and, I think, importantly, given the kind of middle class base of the movement, the smashing of this kind of sense of the possibility of upward mobility and aspiration on quite a mass scale. And I think the centre there went into a political crisis as people moved away from it, seeking, you know, new politics both on the left around things like, you know, Bernie Sanders, the DSA, Chapo Trap House is sort of, you know, the memey, you know, funny alternative of the alt-right, I guess, or the alt-left, people have called it. And I think the creativity that's unleashed by this kind of political, you know, movement away from the centre has, yeah, taken on the strange form, both on the left and the right, of, like, internet memes. So a word on Trump, like, I think his presidential campaign was a major boon for the alt-right, and everyone acknowledges this, obviously. But figures like Andrew Anglin actually mark it as the beginning of the alt-right. You know, like in things like online meme campaigns to attack Hillary Clinton and to boost Donald Trump. And I think, you know, Donald Trump's presidency has given them a massive boost and a boost in their confidence, sort of shifting politics to the right. They call it the Overton window, what's kind of normal to talk about. And sort of setting, you know, in the words of Richard Spencer, just sort of starting to set the right tone around immigrants with his idea, keep in mind of, you know, mass deportation of those migrants and eventually, you know, a white ethno-state. And then Trump's comments after Charlottesville about there being very fine people on both sides is pretty indicative of some of that as well. Like, basically openly apologising for, you know, for fascists. Now, a little bit, I think, on... I just want to turn to sort of the theme of, like, how they generally are understood and why it's really bad, generally, the way that they're understood. Because I think, yeah, it's worth going into some detail on this, because I think it's something that you see a lot around the left and, you know, a lot of people who mean well can just get this stuff really wrong. And I think some of these ideas are quite dismissive and just thoroughly misorienting to people who actually want to fight and stop movements like these from growing. First, I think probably we can all agree that, you know, they're not this meme wing of some shadowy Russian spy ring that's aimed at influencing the US election, as the news actually has been arguing for the last couple of months. But I think, yeah, on a more serious note, they're like, are they just sort of a bunch of sad, kind of neck-bearded, basement-dwelling, you know, people who just need to sort of grow up and kind of... Okay, we can debate this out. Do they sort of just need to kind of, you know, learn from the mainstream, just normalise a bit and everything will kind of be fine? I think that's the most prominent. And I think that kind of dismissal, although it can be true, just using it as a dismissal of their politics is one of the most misorienting sort of things that gets said about these movements. Because the thrust of it is surely the mainstream will sort them out. That pushes directly against, you know, I think the most important factor in taking them on, you know, which is building left-wing protest movements that can confront them and stop them from growing, and also to build kind of, you know, a fighting left in society that can take the space from them on a more fundamental level. And I think this mistake is made particularly by people like Angela Nagel, whose book this talk is named after, Kill All Normies. I think she actually puts an argument against protest and I think generally sort of has that quite dismissive view of the alt-right that comes up in a lot of things she says. I think one other way that she does that is to just describe them as amoral, and that's really telling. So in her words on Chapo Trap House, they're like people who just don't know that kicking someone in the head is wrong, which just really shades into that idea that, you know, growing up will be the death of them, you know, which she has argued, and she did argue after Charlottesville, you know, saying that now a lot of them are in their 20s and 30s, you know, they've kind of grown up, they don't really have the same, you know, puerile kind of infantile desire to shock and offend people. So kind of there goes the basis for your movement. Like, see you later. I think it's absolute, just absolute nonsense. Like, if there's one thing you take away from this talk, like, just it's based firstly on the idea that the alt-right's ideas are somehow in opposition to the mainstream and mainstream morality, which is just so wrong if you look at kind of, you know, the level of racism and sexism and authoritarianism in mainstream society, as I've kind of gone through. And secondly, yeah, they're quite misanthropic, but they're not amoral. They're constructing, you know, and drawing on a morality that's just built around, you know, like white civilization or white people. Like, there's a distinct morality to it. It's just a right wing one. I think a connected dismissal that kind of gets made as well is that the alt-right's just driven by this sort of, as I touched on, this just desire for transgression and to just offend people. You know, just yeah, with their memes and their trolling, it's just this big. It's all for the lulz. Which, you know, Milo actually argues in, I think, a way that's quite strategic and defensive. Angela Nagel puts a lot of emphasis on this as an explanation for them, though it's true they do it, but an explanation as well. So, yeah, I think it's clearly, like, an important part of how they cohere online and how they sort of train people into sort of accepting some of the sort of dehumanising and oppressive ideas, you know, that they sort of are arguing and pushing in society. But I think while it's useful to understand as that recruiting and cohering tool, which, you know, Angela Nagel does, it really doesn't begin to explain them politically at all. Like, transgression happens both to the left and the right in a political polarisation, as you can see now in the US. And though you can technically call them the same thing, like, they really aren't. They're in totally different directions politically. And I think, yeah, these arguments really just shade into kind of the alt-right's self-characterisation as, you know, these rebels against the stultifying liberal conformity that you see them position around all over the world. And I think even if you think that that is the case, it really is more important that they're rebels for, you know, this sharp and violent rightward shift in society. Like, rebelry has a left and a right, I guess is the point there. So to sort of further underline that, I think transgressive styles are not new in rising fascist movements either, if you look through history, because they, by definition, reach outside of and to the right of the mainstream. So Salvador Dali, for instance, I'm really happy that I got to include the Salvador Dali quote, proclaimed in 1934 that Hitler's surrealist personality was as admirable as that of de Sade or of Le Tremont. So, you know, just admiration of Hitler for being a bit sort of transgressive. One historian actually has just argued more generally that the lure of fascism among intellectuals and artists has its origin in just the sheer rebelliousness in this anarchistic revolt directed against the established order. So I think one way that Nagel kind of pushes this is to sort of go so far as to say that the alt-right is counter-hegemonic, in her words. And I think, yeah, in fact, when you just see, like, racism and sexism and inhumanity is quite indispensable cause of capitalism. And also these realities that are concealed or apologised for, I think, by liberalism as well, which they, you know, love to skewer. The alt-right's project to actually renew and radicalise those is completely in line with hegemonic ideas. And I think this gets to the core of liberal politics. It really absolutely refuses to countenance that fascism always overlaps with, you know, hegemonic ideas under capitalism. So I think a few comments on one of the main online activities of the movement, which is memeing, as people know. People dismiss them because a lot of their activity is on the internet. So it's important to understand, I think, how these activities contribute to the movement building. One good formulation of it, I think, is one commentator who said the alt-right's trolling is actually the new cross-burning. And I think there are real parallels there. More importantly, I think memes are kind of the welcome mat for the alt-right, an important part of what people do to move towards sort of more activity in the movement, you know, creating, sharing, and importantly, kind of internalising the political content. So Andrew Anglin, the Daily Stormer guy, put it best, I think. A movement which meets all of the Southern Poverty Law Center's definitions of neo-Nazi, white supremacism, using a cartoon frog to represent itself. That's peppy if people don't know the green sort of funny frog that they appropriated. Using a cartoon frog to represent itself takes on a subversive power to bypass historical stereotypes of such movements and thus present the ideas themselves in a fun way without the baggage of Schindler's List and American History X. And on the broader topic of irony, which is a key part of kind of memes, he adds, in an age of nihilism, absolute idealism must be couched in irony in order to be taken seriously. This is because anyone who attempts to present himself as serious will immediately be viewed as the opposite through the jaded lens of our postmodern milieu. I would add that the form is important as well. Memes and jokes can contain all the basic material of sort of their fascist politics without explicitly stating any of the ideological positions. So, you know, the hate you see, the hatred, the desire for violence, the mocking of their political enemies, and the sense of just really bitter betrayal and alienation, all expressed, but packaged up in a way that suggests it's all somehow new and original and just and funny and lighthearted. And as sort of Andrew Anglin notes, talking about the development of the 4chan culture, you know, the kind of message board culture that a lot of the alt-right sprang from, anti-Semitic and racist jokes began, but soon transformed into more serious as the people in the boards realised that they agreed with them. So that encapsulates it pretty well. And I think the free helicopter rides meme is actually a pretty good example of this. And here's a blue screen. Anyway, I'll just describe it. It's basically, there it is. So I think, like, there you kind of see, yeah, Pusheen, who people are probably familiar with, the cute cat that everyone loves. But he's wearing a Make America Great Again Trump hat, and he's got Pepe in the back seat, kind of small. And they're pushing out, you know, left-wing activists into this giant pile of corpses, and then Pusheen's just sort of smiling and waving at the end there. And I think, you know, under a, you know, quite thin veneer, obviously, of humour, you know, it really naturalises the kind of real sentiment that draws people into these movements, and they actually have killed, you know, left-wing activists. And obviously people will notice the nod to where that was done on a mass scale, you know, by Pinochet, you know, in Chile after the sort of revolution there. To just, yeah, they would take left-wing activists out and, like, push them out of helicopters over bodies of water to kill them en masse. So I want to move on now to some points about sort of how the movement's structured and sort of finish off there. Firstly, I think an important division that people get hung up on, and I think misunderstand some of the time, is the division between the alt-right and the alt-light. And Angela Nagel is an example of this. And also some comments just about sort of the class nature of the movement as well, because I think that's important. So the division between what's called the alt-right and the alt-light has been greatly overstated, I think, among smaller liberals, but also on the left. I think I want to say a few things on it. Broadly, I think it's described as the division between those who are openly or explicitly for, you know, a white racial basis, a sort of biological basis to the movement's politics. People like Richard Spencer and Andrew Anglin. And on the other side, the alt-light, the people who aren't. Who prefer to sort of emphasise Western civilization. And I think it's important in a way because it's actually been used to dismiss calls for protesting figures like Milo. I'm strongly for protesting figures like Milo, but people will say, oh, well, he's not a fascist, he's not even part of the real alt-right, so why would you protest him? Which I think gets the situation really wrong. There is a difference of opinion, obviously, in politics between these two wings of the movement, and some different dynamics, I think, to their development and different spaces in which they can and ways in which they can develop. You know, Milo, for instance, emphasises building this troll army and going on speaking tours, whereas Andrew Anglin, you know, from the Daily Storm, emphasises a leaderless movement from the bottom up because he doesn't trust leaders to be hard enough on anti-Semitism. And Spencer, you know, recruiting ideological young people from the campus into organisations. So I think one starting point where they all absolutely meet is the need to build a movement, which comes back to one of the core parts of fascist politics. And I think Milo's kind of karaoke video where he's singing America the Brave or whatever in front of, you know, Spencer and others and receiving, like, the Sieg Heil Nazi salutes is pretty indicative of that overlap. So, yeah, I think we should just not get caught up in what a movement says about itself, but analyse its actual politics and it's the dynamics in which it exists to actually understand it. And I think when you put it in context, it becomes pretty clear that the division between these two supposed wings of the movement is actually an important division of labour rather than an opposition. And in a climate, I think that's because in a climate where liberalism predominates and people have to be sort of recruited through that, you know, this revulsion at a certain level of openness with racism. You know, you can be racist, but do it in the sort of right way and in a polite way. Yeah, people have to be recruited through that to the more open and theorised forms of racism and the more violent ones. So I think openly fascist politics, you know, there's certain levels of space and limitations to that. Like in Charlottesville, it was pretty clear afterwards that a lot of the sections of the movement felt like it was an overreach. And they were too open with the Nazi symbolism and needed to be more minimal in order to actually, in the long term, reel people into those ideas. And I think, importantly, the context of, like, we're in the sort of political crisis in the moment that we're in is the mainstream shifting right. There is a dynamic more towards the radicalisation of this movement and that favours the right wing of it and favours the sort of what they call the alt-right. Not some sort of faction fight that the alt-light will be able to win over the alt-right. Like, so I think context is important there. And I think when you see it in this light, it's a fascist movement with, you know, a soft wing that allows it to drive itself into the mainstream rather than, you know, and feed from the mainstream rather than this trolling movement with this marginal kind of extreme right wing that's the sort of argument of people like Molly Yiannopoulos. I think it's important to say as well, the divisions that do exist between them They're not natural, or owing to some internal kind of logical clash. They agree on most things, really. Though it sort of imply that there's this real division or this real natural, you know, logical opposition. I think they're basically a product of pressure that's applied from protest and the left. And I think, yeah, we've had quite a lot of success at this here, and we've seen that sort of success around the world. You know, wherever there's opposition to them, it can apply that pressure and put them in situations where they do split and they do splinter. And I think that's one of the key things to actually stopping them from growing. You know, the sort of backlash after Charlottesville was a good example of this. You know, where Steve Bannon kind of distanced himself from the whole alt-right movement. The head of, you know, one of their major organisations, Identity Europa, you know, was sort of forced to step down because the membership sort of was really strongly against the positioning around Nazi sort of imagery and stuff. So moving on to class, I think it's one aspect that kind of gets missed, I think, generally, or just, you know, sort of like it gets talked about in this, oh, well, it's the white working class kind of a way. And I want to say a few words about it. And I think, yeah, one of the key things is actually, you know, at its core, it's a middle class movement with this real disdain for the working class. But at the same time, there's a turn away, I think, in American fascism from this respectability and aspirationalism towards kind of more populist demands like single-payer healthcare for white people. I think you can look at the people in the movement. That's one way of doing it. I don't think it gets you all the way. Like the fact that Richard Spencer's family owns like 5,000 acres of farmland. Or, you know, when they showed out at Charlottesville, it wasn't like, you know, downtrodden workers. It was like people in waistcoats. I don't think it gets you far enough. I think you've got to look at the politics of the movement through history as well. And this is one of the, like, yeah, one of the interesting and important, I think, ways to sort of, you know, characterise their politics. And why it is historically that these ideas are sort of associated with, you know, a mobilised radical middle class movement. Yeah. And I think that's just generally, yeah, people can maybe go into that in a bit more detail because I'm running out of time in the discussion. But yeah, I think, like, yeah, it's that sort of visceral, quite visceral sort of hatred for oppressed people that I think can come up in periods of crisis. So on the sort of alt-right's populist welfare state for whites argument, which I think is really significant because it really shows this, there's a space for this movement that's opening up to the right of the mainstream right, and the space to build an extra parliamentary movement. I think it allows them to posture on racist welfare state rhetoric and to sort of be less respectable and more vulgar, both in their politics and their kind of irreverent meme-y style. Excuse me, I got a cold. Because their aim really is no longer to just get into the Republican Party and run capitalism. You know, their aim is to build a mass movement that can mobilise around, you know, political aims and goals. And I think the contrast with the longer-running sections of the American far right, like American Renaissance, is really instructive. Like, American Renaissance is marked by this more aspirational fascism and sort of argues, Jared Taylor, the leader, has argued that demands are ungentlemanly and hence unbecoming of the white movement. He denies that whites are among the poor at all and actually says that income inequality is a phony debate. And I think, yeah, so Spencer and Anglin, by contrast, kind of express their anger at income equality, but they blame the Jews while pointing to the white welfare state, as I've said. And even a universal basic income for white people. Spencer actually argues that the trillions spent on war could be better spent on things that are immediately useful to white people. The interests of businessmen and global merchants, like that's in triple parentheses because he's talking about Jews, should never take precedence over workers. That's obviously white workers. One thing to say briefly, I don't think anti-Semitism is this sort of optional extra for fascism, as I've said, but it's actually their way of like trying to theorise crisis in capitalism without pointing to the actual beneficiaries or any kind of struggle that can take it on. Or, you know, pointing to some arbitrary part of them in like the Jewish capitalists. So you could call that like a deflected theory of anti-capitalism, I think, if you wanted to sort of make it sound smart. And I think it has been, but I can't find examples of it. Anglin puts it like this. Economics should follow common sense, a free market socialism, which would fall into place if Jews were physically removed. And I think there's actually been a 60% jump, apparently, in anti-Semitic incidents in the US between 2016 and 17, which I think, yeah, shows you sort of the extent of the anti-Semitism in the movement. Even though, yeah, it's kind of hard to get a sense of quite how hard it's sort of theorised out by sections of the movement. I think, like, it's been said that, like, the alt-right are champions of the white working class. And, like, obviously, it's absolute bullshit. Like, Milo Yiannopoulos talks about, like, his critique of the left is that, you know, white workers are some of the most marginalised people in the world and the left has sort of left them behind. And, you know, this is after he's ditched his, like, stop being poor T-shirt that he used to wear before Trump was elected. Mm. He's, at the same time, called for, you know, a sense of his, like, core politics. He's called for deepening austerity and sort of taxing the poor and letting the rich off taxation because, like, you know, that's how you encourage innovation and hard work. It's all the same crap you hear from sort of, you know, a lot of sort of, like, middle-class people and liberals and stuff. And he sort of really proudly valorizes himself as scabs, like, even in a time where there's not, like, you know, the level of, I think, like, working-class struggle is relatively low historically, but rising. He can't resist kind of lining himself up against that and sort of saying, you know, he identifies as a scab. And it describes that as a derogatory word that's used by unionized workers to describe strike breakers, members of the working class who, during a strike, decided that forcing unionized industries to give them a pay rise every week might not be entirely reasonable, or that feeding their families took priority over an abstract idea of left-wing solidarity. And I think it's also key to see, like, there's a layer of, like, working class hatred even in the racism. Like, in his Neil Mitchell interview, he sort of went through, like, how, you know, the Muslims in Australia are much better because, you know, they could afford to fly here, so they're more middle class. Whereas in Europe, you know, they came by boat or they came over land, so they're more working class. So clearly they're worse. So, yeah, I think that's quite telling. So just to close, I think it's worth kind of asking the question that a number of commentators actually have been for a few months now, particularly in the recent weeks, after Richard Spencer called off his college tour. You know, isn't the alt-right just dead anyway? You know, did all you guys just come here to celebrate, basically? You know, for sure, like, the best ever quote from the alt-right has been, like, one of them has been Richard Spencer saying that, like, he can't do his college tours because the protest men, they're just not fun anymore. And it's also true, I think, that since Charlottesville, you know, that overreach that I mentioned and the protest on our part has meant that, you know, there's been backlash and infighting and fragmentation on their side. But I think it shows us the importance, really, of, like, kind of having a serious analysis and, like, I think a Marxist analysis of the alt-right, like the one that I've outlined in this talk, which situates it in class struggle and capitalist crisis and the perennial but fluctuating space for fascist politics that exists within that. I think, really, that's the only way to, like, understand them in a total sort of way. Like, these people are not going away despite having moments of retreat. The far right's growing and advancing, you know, in, you know, large parts of the world. And crisis and struggles, I've said, is not going away in the US. And there is a fascist sympathiser sitting in the White House in Donald Trump. And we need to be crystal clear on all that, I think, and on how quickly and dangerously these movements can cohere, both in the US and here and all around the world. The mainstream certainly is not going to sort them out. It's going to support them. So, yeah, we really are the people who are going to have to fight. And beyond that, I think to really fight them at their roots and to put fascism right into the dustbin of history forever, where it belongs, is also getting rid of the rotten system of capitalism that breeds them in the first place. I'll leave it there.